It's Depression Mode. I'm John Moe. I'm glad you're here. It would be easy to think that you don't have very much in common with the musician Shamir. You probably didn't have a huge hit song when you were barely out of high school. Shamir did. This is called If It Wasn't True. You probably also didn't have several acclaimed albums and EPs over the past 8 years. Shamir's latest is called Heterosexuality. But if you're a listener of the show, you may very well have dealt with some mental health issues, just as Shamir has. Shamir has bipolar disorder and has spent time in an inpatient facility after a breakdown. Shamir is non-binary and has said in the past that he does not have a preferred pronoun, though he's more comfortable with he, him than they, them. Shamir grew up in Las Vegas, and his home included his mother's twin sister, who is a songwriter and arranger, always had musicians around the house playing and recording songs. Shamir has become known for a music that's kind of a combination of house music, hip-hop, disco. But when he first started making his own stuff, it was something pretty different.
Initially, country and folk.
Country and folk. That surprises me. That's not what I associate with your music. Why country and folk?
That's what I loved. I wanted to be a country musician. And my freshman year of high school, I was going to honky-tonks and doing the whole thing. Yeah, the reality of me being me and trying to break into the country music scene hit me like a brick, which then made me angsty, which then sent me over the punk. But I was listening to like everything, but I specifically wanted to do country.
Who were your big influences in country?
A lot of that older stuff. So when I was growing up, there was two country stations in Las Vegas. And think about Las Vegas and, you know, Nevada in general, a lot of people, like, you know, they think of the glitz and glam and like Elvis and shit, but like, you know, it's a big country town, and there's two country stations, and one of them, I think it was, I don't know if there's still two or even if this station is still, because, you know, I don't live in Vegas anymore. I don't even know if this station is still operating or if they even do this, but I knew it was 105, I think 105.5, something like that. Every Sunday morning, they would play all the country oldies, and that's what I liked. I didn't really like new country at the time. I didn't really get into new country until middle school-ish, when my friend Krista, she's from Texas, and she kind of got me to some of like the new country then. But even then, I still was like very leery about new country. But I loved all the old stuff, and you know, I was listening to like, they play like Patsy Cline and Loretta Lynn and Marty Robbins, who I like love. And yeah, and like Mule Haggard, and just like a lot of like that old stuff, that old sounding stuff. And like, that's the stuff that I like the most as well.
You referenced you being who you are. When did you come to understand that you were non-binary?
Probably puberty.
Yeah. Did you have a word for it then? Did you understand that you might fit some sort of classification after all?
No, the kind of like go-to word that like, I don't know if I used it or if that was just like the easy go-to word before we had the language, but you know, it was always just like, you know, androgyny, something along those lines. But yeah, I didn't feel, I guess there was always kind of like this like internal disconnect with like, you know, me and like other boys. But I never let that like stop me. It was more so like, The other boys stopped me. It made me aware that, like, you know, you're not like us. And then that was kind of like even more impactful in middle school when my voice just didn't change and my hair got longer because I started growing my dreads, which added to the androgyny even more, which is like not always the case because I just wanted dreads. Like, dreads are cool. And it's just like, yeah, you know, didn't get the same amount of body hair as all the other boys, and it was a weird time.
Were you bullied?
Yes and no. Like, not devastatingly so, like, in a way that, like, I think all kids are to some degree. But, you know, also, this country is, North Las Vegas specifically, where I'm from, can be still, you know, very liberal and open. And there's just, like, a lot of queer kids where I, you know, grew up in. So that was nice.
I heard you say in an interview that The Who was a favorite band of yours as a kid. What was it about their music when you discovered it and really got into it? What was it?
Well, I discovered The Who when I was like, they're great. Like when I picked up the guitar, watching The Who made me like want to pick up the guitar. And I guess that's like where my love like for rock music basically like started and began.
What was it about that music that drew you in?
The urgency, I guess, yeah. The angst and urgency, I guess.
Were you, like, you were relating to the sound of it or the lyrical content of it or what?
I don't know. I mean, I always reference, I mean, the story goes, you know, I saw, like, clips of The Who, you know, playing My Generation on, like, one of those late night shows where they, like, you know, played it and destroyed all the instruments and stuff. And yeah. And then like a week later, I was like, Ma, take me to, I think Tower was still a thing then.
Okay.
And I got like a Who Best Of album. And that was like one of my first records like ever.
Wow. I'm significantly older than you are, enough so that when I was in junior high, I went and saw The Clash opening for The Who at the Kingdom in Seattle. It was a terrible space for it, and both bands were just not in shape, but it was still like, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening. It was pretty great.
Yeah, I would pay big bucks to see either of those bands not in shape.
Your debut album, Ratched, came out and kind of exploded right out of the gate. How did that come about? How did you go from being, you know, a teenager to getting this album out into the world?
So I graduated high school in about, that was like summer 2013. And then I was going to go to school actually for culinary arts, but I didn't want to be in debt. And I had secured a job a week after I graduated high school. So I immediately started working and I was saving up for school, basically, to go to culinary arts school. I was working at a Ross Dress for Less retail. And I had moved back in with my mom. And basically, the plan was, because I wasn't living with my mom, like, most of, like, senior year. I was, like, living with a cousin because, like, me and my mom were, like, clashing. And I'm like, I'm leaving. I moved back in with her after graduation. And the plan was to just, you know, live with her for free, save up, and go to school. But basically, she was like, the only way that you can live with me for free is if you still focus on your music and art. Because my mom is very new age hippie vibes. Not your classic mom, you know, young mom. You know, cool hippie young mom.
Yeah, that's not the pressure one normally gets from one's parents.
Exactly, exactly.
Go out and do music.
Yeah, sometimes it's like, sometimes in moments like this, it's just like, you know, I'm glad that she's who she is. But then, like, sometimes I wish, like, you know, I could have been guided and pushed to more, like, normal, stable things instead of having to, like, learn the hard way how to do it as an adult. But that's a whole nother conversation. But I really was just making demos when I got off of work, if I still had energy, to kind of appease her. And then she got on my nerves, I think, like, a couple months into it. And then I was like, I'm moving out. And she was sad. So I thought about all the demos that I had did. And I was like, what if I send these demos out to like a couple small tape labels, see if, you know, they like them. And if so, you know, they'll make a couple and I can give one to my mom before I like go out into the regular working world so she can at least, you know, have, you know, see that I still at the very least care about art. one of the small tape labels I ended up sending it to was God Mode, and they loved it so much that they flew me out to New York. We recorded two songs over a weekend. I went back home, and a month later, one of those two songs was Best New Track on Pitchfork. And then literally instantly the next day, label offers came through.
Wow. What was that like? Like, were you, I mean, how did you take that when that sudden flood came?
I spiraled. Like, it was wild. I was like, when it got the Best New Track release, and it wasn't even like an official single, it was a song that was on a compilation album for the label. So that was even crazier. So I just like, I was not expecting that. So, you know, I'm literally like, so at this point I had to quit Ross before I went to New York, and I secured another job at Topshop, which was like much better for me because I liked their clothes and the discount was amazing.
And, but you didn't think when you went to New York, you didn't think, okay, now I'm going to hit it big. I don't need retail job anymore.
No, I got another job.
Yeah.
I got another job. I was either off or not work or hadn't started yet. And I was literally just sitting on my mom's couch, like in my underwear. She was at work. It was just like, I was just by myself watching TV, and my phone was just kept on buzzing. And I was like, what is going on? And I see what was going on. And like the label owner at the time, you know, called me and filled me in, and like they were like, we can just like, you know, act as your manager. And they did throughout that whole process, which was like great that I at least had that at the time. But yeah, I was freaking out. And I want to say like a week later I met with my first label.
And then how long between that and the album coming out?
Less than 6 months. Less than 6 months between when On the Regular, the first single, had came out, and then I will say about a year by the time the album had came out.
So you're still really young at this point. You're still like, what, 20 years old or so?
I was 19 when the first single came out. I was 20 when the album came out, yeah.
Okay. What was it like to deal with that kind of sudden fame and popularity?
I was just on autopilot the entire time.
What do you mean?
Like there was no time to feel it. It was just do.
Just get to the next thing.
Just get to the next thing, to just do it there. It didn't, yeah, like there was just a lot of urgency.
Did you like the music on it?
Yeah, I think it's good. I don't think it represented me as an artist, though.
Yeah, I was going to say, because after that album, your music changed pretty significantly.
Yeah.
Why was that?
Because of the urgency and, you know, me not being able to breathe and take a beat, I kind of just went along with things because, you know, it's a situation of like, you know, if you don't strike while the iron is hot, then there's a chance that it'll never be hot again, basically, I guess. And, you know, at the time, I was influenced to, you know, continue a style, because again, I didn't know that one of the two songs that I recorded over a weekend was going to, you know, basically like set off this career for me. So I was more experimental when I went to go record those songs, especially because, like, you know, someone else paid for it. You know what I mean? So I was more open to do something that was out of my comfort zone. Had I known that one of those two songs was going to like spark off this, you know, career, I would have been a little bit more critical about implementing myself and my instincts a little bit more. But once that song was already out, everyone's like, yeah, you have to like continue this vibe.
And that was On the Regular, the song?
No, the first song before On the Regular, because On the Regular was after I got signed, the first song that got Best New Track that led to me getting signed was called If It Wasn't True.
Okay. Okay. And so then, Ratchet comes out, it's popular, you change your music, you know, why didn't you just go along with it and make more of the same music that you had been coached to make already? Why the big shift? Why give up the thing that had worked?
Because the thing that had worked made me like not happy and didn't make me feel seen. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't fulfilling at all. I had did all these like amazing things and I found myself on the under end of it feeling worse than when I started. Like at that point, I was like, I would have rather just stayed at retail by the end of it, which was like really dark. Like I remember actually vividly having a conversation with my management and been like, is there any way that we could just like end all of this and I just can go back to retail?
Wow. because it wasn't you?
It wasn't. You know what I mean? It's just like...
It wasn't who you wanted to be.
Yeah, it just wasn't... It wasn't who I am as an artist.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you can... And, like, it, you know, that works for, like, some people, but I had a vision. Like, if you are just, like, a singer, you just want to be a pop star, then you sing these songs, you do these things that is just, like, popular, maybe, like, chasing a trend or, like, whatever. And you're fine with that, right? Like, you just want to be a singer. You just want to perform. You just want to be an entertainer. I never wanted to be an entertainer. I still don't even think of myself as an entertainer. I think of myself as, like, an artist and kind of, like, unfortunately in music as an artist. If that's your medium, you're kind of, like, pushed to entertain as well, which I think those are, like, two different things.
Do you think that's helped you as an artist that you, you know, can kind of take it or leave it when it comes to the glamour part of it? And maybe prefer to leave it.
Absolutely. Because like what I care, because the thing about it for me and like, you know, I, you know, during that time when I was struggling during the first record, you know, you get into these existential things, right? And I'm just like, if I was to die tomorrow, then this is the sole album that is going to be a part of my legacy, that like, this is the art type of artist that they thought Shamir was. Mm-hmm. That would make my spirit so sad. Mm. You know what I mean? Like, that would just, like, suck. And, like, when I'm gone, my art and my music is going to be literally the only thing that's going to outlast me.
Yeah.
And so I want it to represent me.
And so that's what you set out to do with, was Hope that you put out after that. That was an EP, right?
That was an album. It was an album.
Oh, it was a full album. Okay. Mm-hmm. Did that feel more true? Did that feel better to have made that one, which you produced that yourself or close to it?
Yeah. I mean, it felt better for sure because it felt like me. Again, I made that record thinking it was, you know, could possibly be the last thing that anyone can hear from me. I thought that was going to be the case. Like, I thought that that, like, record would just, like, end everything. Like, people would be like, this is insane. It's a mess. And then just go on to the next. And I still would have been okay with that because, like, at least that project felt true to, like, my soul and, like, my spirit.
Yeah. You had, and I believe it was after the Hope album, you had what I've seen described as a psychotic break. Mm-hmm. How did that go down? More with Shamir in just a moment. We'll go to the break with a track of his called What Else from his 2017 album, Hope. I don't have much to say, but what I've been feeling lately, just wanna play my own way. You know what I like? I like when things are easy. Man, easy things are just the best. Because obviously, there are plenty of parts of life already that can be very, very difficult. So bring on the easy. My favorite easy things, I have to admit, are when something seems like it would be difficult, but turns out to be easy. Oh, I love that. Case in point, building your own website and web presence with Squarespace. I did this years ago and found it to be delightfully simple. I can build a site, make changes, redesign everything if I want, all very simple. Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform for entrepreneurs to stand out and succeed online. Squarespace makes it easy to create a beautiful website, engage with your audience, and sell anything from products to content to time, all in one place, all on your terms. You don't need to be a web guru. You become the guru. Start a completely personalized website with the new guided design system, Squarespace Blueprint. You can choose from professionally curated layout and styling options to build a unique online presence from the ground up, tailored to your brand or business and optimized for every device. Make checkout seamless for your customers with simple but powerful payment tools. They accept credit cards, PayPal, and Apple Pay, and in eligible countries, offer customers the option to buy now and pay later with Afterpay and ClearPay. Upload video content, organize your video library, and showcase your content on beautiful video pages. You can even sell access to your video library by adding a paywall to your content. So why not get started now? Go to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/depresh to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. squarespace.com/depresh. Back with Shamir, I asked him about his psychotic break, which came in 2017, right after he self-released his album, Hope.
And it got like a lot more attention than I thought that it would because I had just put it on SoundCloud, you know? Mm-hmm. That week, my best friend since like eighth grade had came to Philly to visit me. And that's when she kind of like noticed that like something was off. And I felt a little off, but I was just like, yeah, just like fully like manic. And at this point, I had like not been diagnosed with anything. And I was just kind of like manic throughout that time that she was here. And then after she left, I still just like felt very jittery and like manic and like couldn't rest. And then I tried to like self-medicate like as much as I can.
What'd you use?
Weed, alcohol, both, you know, and the mixture of the substances basically like pushed it to a full-blown psychotic episode. And like, yeah, and then everything was just like spotty until like next thing I know, I'm like, in the psych ward.
Spotty, like you didn't remember what you were doing? It wasn't being saved in your memory?
It was like an outer body experience. It felt more like a lucid dream. You know what I mean? You remember like my friends calling me. I kind of like remember like getting into the ambulance, like out my house. And then like everything between that is like really, really spotty. And then like next thing I know, I'm just like, yeah, in the hospital. I remember kind of just like waking up in the hospital, like finally like feeling like myself, like feeling like in my body and walking into the lobby and like, you know, asking the lady in the front, like, hi, can I get some information, please?
What am I doing here?
Why am I in a gown?
Where am I?
Where are my clothes?
Right. Do you know how you ended up in the hospital? Like the event that led to that? What was that?
Yeah, so my friends at the time dropped me off from the emergency room and called my mom. And then my mom flew out, like, the first flight to Philly. And, yeah, I mean, I think I, like, by the time they sedated me, I think I, like, slept for, like, a day or something. That's why, like, by the time I woke up, that's when I kind of was just, like, disoriented, and it was just like, what's going on? I kind of like, again, it's so spotty, like I kind of remember like my mom visiting me the night before, and I was like, is my mom here? And he was like, yeah. And I was like, okay. And so then I was like able to like call her, and then yeah, and then I was there for a week and then went back to Vegas with her.
And is that during that week is when you were diagnosed with bipolar?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Were you familiar with it when they told you that?
Yeah, I actually was.
Okay. I mean, how was it explained to you how your case of bipolar existed and how, you know, what did the doctor say?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty much a classic case, you know what I mean? You know, lots of depression, short burst of energy, which is still true to this day, really the thing that it's usually like kind of like outside forces that trigger like psychotic episodes. And in my case, substances can. So that's why like I'm fine with alcohol. I can't smoke weed. I can't like that's like literally like my psychiatrist like no more weed, which is unfortunate because I do like smoking weed. So yeah, I haven't smoked weed in like 2 years because it's just it's like playing Russian roulette. You never know, like some days it can be fine and then some days it could trigger an episode.
Is it trigger the manic episode of a bipolar
situation? I can still be manic. I still have my manic moments, but they're more manageable when I'm sober.
Yeah. How have you been treating it, the bipolar?
Well, relative sobriety, basically, at this point, because I'm so sensitive to, like, a lot of medications. I've tried, like, so many. And honestly, to be honest, I was doing a lot of the medications just so I can continue to smoke weed.
What? And how does that work?
Yeah, I mean, it does work for some people. Some people can do both. I can't. I was too sensitive. And so my psychiatrist is just like, let's try not doing drugs. And we'll see how you do without medication and then come back to me. And that's been the key.
that's worked. Well, that's wonderful that that's working. But so I just want to understand the mindset a little bit. So your idea was by treating it with the pills, with the pharmacology, that would stabilize you enough to be able to enjoy weed, was exactly the thinking?
Okay. Exactly. young 23-24-year-old Shamir mind, you know, it's just like, I just want to smoke my weed. But, you know, essentially, this is sometimes that really has been the key, because just like I said, even at like the lowest dosages of like some of the different medications that I've tried out, it's just made me like, just like, super robotic, like to the point where it's just like I can barely even emote. And so yeah, like I still have the lows and highs, and like I'm very well aware like when I am manic, but it's just like way manageable. And like, you know, reading, meditating, walking, exercising really just remedies it, and that's usually like all I need to do.
It gets you down off those manic highs.
Exactly, yeah.
Does it help get you out of the depressions as well?
Sometimes. Depression is a little bit harder because, like, the depression episodes, it's like moving through quicksand. Because, like, when you're manic, like, obviously it's easy to, like, go for a walk or, like, exercise or, like, you know, do things. But, like, you know, obviously it's hard to do things, like, when you're depressed. But once you kind of, like, get through kind of the quicksand feeling and just continue to like try to stay as active or do as much, then it starts to get easier.
Yeah. I've talked with people who are bipolar, and they say that there's a lot of the manic, like, you know, after they've been treated, after they've got it better managed, they say that the manic part wasn't fun. It wasn't good. It wasn't healthy, but they do kind of miss it because it was very just productive. Really euphoric. Mm-hmm. It was euphoric, productive. They got a lot of stuff done. They, you know, and they often would feel like, oh, this is just me at my best self. This is me living my best life. Mm-hmm. Did you experience that at all?
Yeah. Yeah, I do from time to time. It's just kind of like this, like, I feel like you have to do the psychiatry and the therapy, right? And, through the therapy side of things, I just learned the tools to kind of just like be aware of myself, just like doing constant check-ins. And it's just like, I just know like when I'm feeling that euphoric feeling, I'm like, Shamir, you're manic right now. So we can do X, Y, Z. You know what I mean? It is kind of like, at least for me, kind of like, not an outer body, but it's still, you know, like I can't control it. I can't just like not be manic, you know what I mean? But I also can like be aware that I'm manic and just find ways to transmute that energy. Unfortunately, it's kind of made me a bit of a workaholic.
Because you address it by going out and making music?
Making music, creating, you know, I run a label. I work with other artists. Like I do a lot of things that kind of like keep me occupied, and it's kind of great for both when I'm manic and depressed too, because like when I get couple plates spinning when I'm manic. And if I'm depressed and like know that I have like these plates spinning, that's kind of like the motivation to get me to, you know, work through it.
That's a lot of good learning, and that's a lot of good work that you're doing. And like you say, it takes a while to learn how to do that. Mm-hmm. Is that wisdom that you've cultivated, does that show up in your music? Does your knowledge, relatively new knowledge about your mental health, show up in your music?
I think so, yeah. And I also, like, I want to be clear that to be able to work my life around my mental illness is a privilege that a lot of people don't have. I'm self-employed and make my own schedule and do that. And so I'm able to do that. And I think the hardest thing about being mentally ill is the fact that, like, as mentally ill people have to, like, adapt to, like, this very, like, regimented world, right? And so it gets harder to manage when you have a 9-to-5 and, like, when you have kids and, like, when you have all of these things, you know what I mean? Where it's just, like, my lifestyle as it is right now, I'm able to work around my moods, basically. So that's, like, I always, like, want to, like, specify that because that is a huge privilege. And my heart goes out to people who literally just can't do that.
More with Shamir in just a moment.
Thank you so much to everyone who participated in this year's Max Fun Drive. If you're a member who wants to purchase additional patches, our annual shop is now live. The proceeds for this year's sale will be going to Trans Lifeline. Anytime is a good time to donate to Trans Lifeline, but this year it feels particularly important. Trans Lifeline is a nonprofit for the trans community by the trans community. We're grateful that with your support, we'll be able to help Trans Lifeline connect trans folks to the support and resources they need to survive and thrive. The sale will run until Friday, May 20th. Folks at the $10 monthly level and above will have access to all of the patches from the drive. We also have a special network patch starring Nutsy that all members can purchase. For more information on Trans Lifeline, visit translifeline.org. And for more information on the patches, head to MaximumFun.org/patch sale.
Hey, this is Alden Ford.
And Mujan Zafagari.
And we are here with all the other creators of Mission to Zix.
Hello. Hey.
You're not going to say our names, too?
No, it's a short promo. Yeah,
sort of speech.
Now, with the end of our fifth and final season just a few weeks away, we want to say thank you to Maximum Fun and to every single one of you who has listened to and supported Mission to Zix.
Thank you. And if you haven't checked it out, well, Mission to Zix is an improvised space opera with blockbuster quality sound design, a score performed by an actual 60-piece orchestra, and hilarious guest comedians on every episode. And as our final episodes air, now is the perfect time to jump on board.
Mm-hmm. That's Mission to Zix, ZYXX on Maximum Fun.
Back with Shamir. A songwriter, a musical artist, any kind of artist really, is likely to draw from their own experiences in making their art. I asked Shamir if he feels a responsibility to talk about his experiences with mental health in the art that he makes.
Not a responsibility. I don't see it as a responsibility. I see it as something like nice, you know what I mean? Like I feel like we aren't, like, it's not our responsibility to be like, be charitable, but we should just want to be. That's how I feel. I feel like, you know, it's not my responsibility to dismantle the stigma around mental illness, but I like to.
Yeah, it would be nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I've never, you know, recorded an album like you do on the regular. When you go into something like creating an album of songs, you know, this compilation mm-hmm. of songs, are you trying to give like a portrait of yourself? Like, this is who I am in this moment that I'm recording this? Or is it just, here's some songs I thought up, I'm going to put them together?
No, when it comes to my albums, they are, yeah, it's nice to say those like portraits because that's what it is. Like, I feel like another way that I've described this, I look at all my albums as like scrapbooks. of just like where I'm in my life at those times. Because literally after Ratchet, none of my albums were planned. Like, I'll just maybe get inspiration or just like, you know, have a couple songs together that I feel like links and also kind of like, again, like ties into like my life in that moment. And I'm like, oh, I should make an album. And I do.
Is there, you don't have to answer this because this is an annoying artist question, but I just can't help wondering, what's with the antlers on the cover art?
Oh, yeah, no. No, that's cool. No, I like that. I mean, it's a whole thing. It is a whole thing. It's not just a random accessory. It's not a random accessory. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, the whole look for this whole album cycle was based around the Baphomet figure, which is like, you know, the like half goat, half human winged figure that is usually like, you know, used as like the Illuminati, but it's like it's actually like a figure that's like a part of like the Satanic Church. But it's also like a figure that like stands for like duality and like represents duality. And because it's like, you know, half human, half animal, you know, half winged, but it like has legs and has hooves, like it has like that's grotesque to a lot of people, but like really is kind of like there to like represent that duality of all, you know. And me being myself and sitting at a lot of these like intersections, like being Black and being queer and being non-binary and like just all the like, you know, being mentally ill, just like all the like little intersections that I sit at, I feel like to some people, I'm not gonna say all people, but like to some people, I present as grotesque as like the Baphomet because of all the intersections that I sit at. And so, yeah. And so that's kind of like why I adapted like my own version of that. Like, you know, I wanted to make it my own. Like, you know, I don't have like the wings, but like I have the hooves, but like I don't have goat horns, but I have like antlers. So like I wanted it to like be like my own version of it.
Oh, yeah. I get that now. Totally. I heard you on the Homophilia podcast, Dave Holmes' podcast, talking about insomnia, how you're a lifelong insomniac. Is that still the case with you?
Absolutely, yeah. But again, I'm able to like work my life around it, which is nice. So like, yeah, you know, I'll do emails at 3 a.m.
So you have a sleep schedule, but it's just a non-traditional sleep schedule?
Yeah, I would say it's non-traditional and very malleable, like, especially just, you know, traveling as much as I have and, like, everything. I don't, like, I don't get jet lagged. Last time I got, like, truly jet lagged was, like, my last European tour in 2018 when we first got into Glasgow. That was, like, the first time I think I ever, like, really got, like, jet lagged like that. That was, like, a crazy moment. But other than that, like, yeah, I don't get jet lagged or, like, really get thrown off. Like, just, like, if I'm sleepy, then I'm sleepy.
What's your relationship with sleep, then, as an artist? Like, are you, I mean, you've mentioned lucid dreaming. You know, we've talked about the insomnia a little bit. How does that contribute to your creative life in music or in anything else?
I don't know, you know, because I'm not a person who have vivid dreams, if not at all. Like, I'm convinced I don't really have dreams that much. It's rare when I at least remember them. You know, they say that, like, you know, everyone has dreams, you just don't remember them. It's rare that I at least remember them. So sleep to me really just kind of truly just, like, feels like refueling.
Yeah. It's interesting, like, I mean, so much of when we talk about mental illness on the show and I talk to people about mental illness, there's often a perception among people who've never been touched by it that, oh, you know, you have a problem and then maybe you go to a therapist or a psychiatrist, they cure your problem and then you never have it again. And in reality, it's a matter of learning who you are and, you know, fine-tuning the ways that you manage what's going on. And it sounds like you've been doing that with your bipolar and your insomnia, kind of trying to make friends with them and work with them.
They feel connected to me in a lot of ways. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, I will say that, like, there's like a deep connection between like being bipolar and like sleep for me. You know what I mean? Because like, I'm so again, another thing that, like, I have to be careful of, and, like, because that's another thing too, that's another, like, big major thing that I kind of, like, left out when I was talking about the psychotic episode. I didn't sleep for, like, 2 days because I was, like, manic as all. So, like, you know, when I am feeling myself being manic now, like, even if I, you know, don't feel tired or, like, whatever, I carve out, like, more time to just, like, rest. Even if I am, like, feeling, like, manic and, like, jittery, I'll still just, like, carve out the extra time to just, like, even just, like, be in my bed and, like, to, like, scroll if I need to, or to, like, fidget or, like, whatever. I just make sure that I am still for, like, a certain amount of hours until I fall asleep.
What's next for you with your art? What's the next goal, next project?
I don't know. Just like I said, they really come to me. Like, I don't plan them. Like, it just, whenever inspiration strikes, whenever it makes sense. Right now,
what's inspiring you now?
Well, let's get into that.
Sorry about that.
No, right now, I'm writing a lot of country material again. Not for my own self. I've put the Shamir fan group through enough that a lot of this country stuff that I'm writing right now, I don't want to make a Shamir country record. It's just, it's too much. I don't feel like, you know, doing yet another U-turn. And I feel really comfortable in kind of like this, like, indie pop rock sound that I have now. And I think there's still so much to, like, grow off of it. And so the country stuff that's inspiring me right now, like, yeah, it, you know, maybe be under a different moniker or just, like, a thing that, like, I'll quietly release or just, like, something. But, like, yeah, I've been just really into that right now again and been writing a lot of country stuff.
When I think of the old country, and I'm with you, I really go for the old Hank Williams, that George Jones kind of thing. There's so much sadness in that music. And that was exactly sort of the innovation of Hank Williams, is that he came out there and sang about your cheating heart and how, you know, you're going to be miserable forever. And that wasn't widely done in country at the time. Do you think that the depressive part of you was connecting with just all that sorrow in that early country music?
Absolutely. I mean, there's this, we'll be here forever. I don't like, you know what I mean? Like, but yes, basically most, if not all, of these country songs was written during a depressive episode that I had last fall after I had played my first two shows back since the pandemic. And I think it was just such a shock to the system that I fell into, like, a pretty deep depression, like one of the more worst ones in, like, recent history. And kind of, like, one of the few things that can, you know, that was able to, like, keep me going was, like, writing my little classic sounding sad country songs.
Great. Well, I, you know, if you release them under a different identity, if you could slip us the identity so we could enjoy them, I would sure appreciate it.
Yeah.
Shamir, thank you so much for being on Depression Mode.
Thank you.
You can find Shamir's music wherever you find music, and it's really interesting to travel through the last 7 or 8 years of what he's made, the evolution of the sound, the content of the lyrics, especially when you learn, as I think we all have from this interview, how crucial it is for Shamir to portray himself in a way that feels truthful to who he really is. And let's take a moment to kind of find a little bit of peace in our world. Laura House is here for a meditation moment. Hey, Laura.
Hello.
Here's what I keep wondering. If you keep meditating, if, like, you really build it into a practice, mm-hmm. and are disciplined about it, what form does getting good at it take? Like, do you become the most peaceful, or can you get to a peaceful place really fast?
You go to the Meditation World Championships. Uh-huh. They're held in Seattle every fall.
Sure.
I mean, to be honest, it's a little bit of getting there faster in the sense of it's like you've built that muscle. And by muscle, I kind of mean neural pathway in your brain. So, for example, without meditation, my neural pathway of, like, oh no, 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 this is horrible. This sucks. This sucks. This sucks. Like that's my strongest muscle, right?
Yeah, sure.
And then every day I meditate, I let go. I keep going back to that place where I feel good. I feel okay. Like now that muscle, that neural pathway is getting strengthened. So it is more of like pre-life. My car got towed and I'm mad for 6 years.
Right.
And then post-meditation is like, oh, my car got towed. Well, you know, I guess I'll just go pick it up at the tow yard.
Uh-huh.
Like yep. it's a little, it makes the upset sort of less deep, less wide.
Nice. Nice. Well, let's build that muscle now, shall we?
So we want to be seated and in a place where you can safely close your eyes. So not driving. And close your eyes. And the only thing on the to-do list is to notice your breath. So it's already happening. There's nothing to control or change or comment on. You just notice it. And you'll have thoughts. It's normal to have thoughts. And when you're aware of your thoughts, you just notice your breath again. Just letting go. And open your eyes slowly. And congratulations, you did it. You took a moment.
It's remarkable how little absolute silence there is in our day-to-day world.
Yeah.
I always notice that, like, oh, I've never experienced this before since the last time I taped with Laura.
Well, I have mixed feelings about that. Yeah, but I meditate every day and I teach meditation. And even just now, I was like, oh, that's right. Like, I'm right here. Because right. I'm like any other normal person. All day long, I have a to-do list of 37 things. And then sure. I'm in the middle, and I can't do this one till that one. And then it's like, when it's just like, oh, just notice your breath. It really is a reminder, like, oh, I'm this thing.
Yeah.
I'm just here. I'm just a person doing
yeah.
this.
Yeah. I'm an organism and not just a to-do list.
good mantra.
Laura House can be found at laurahouse.com and on the Tiny Victories podcast. Thanks, Laura.
Thank you.
Next time on Depression Mode, we know it's good to talk about mental health, but there are a lot of words to choose from in the English language to do that talking. How do we make sure we're using the right ones?
Crazy. Originally, it meant diseased. That's from the 1570s, but very quickly, about 10 years later, it meant something that's broken or full of cracks. From the early 1600s, it took on this mental health meaning as well. So that's quite quick, I think, just a couple of decades. I don't know generally how the mental health conversation went in the early 1600s. But I'm going to assume not the best, given how a lot of history, and very recent, it has not been the best.
A look at the vocabulary of mental health. I want to thank everyone who donated to Depression Mode during our Max Fun Drive. The response was wonderful. You have helped the show continue to exist. You have helped send all of our episodes and interviews and efforts out to the world. You have helped people. Thank you. Be sure to hit subscribe on Depression Mode. Do that right now. Give us 5 stars. Write reviews. It all helps more people find out about the show, which helps our mission of getting those conversations happening. I want you to know that the Suicide Prevention Lifeline is available 24/7 for free at 1-800-273-8255, 1-800-273-TALK. The Crisis Text Line, also free and always available. Text the word HOME to 741-741. Our electric mail address is depressionmode@maximumfun.org. We'd love to hear from you. If you're on Facebook, look up our mental health discussion group, Preshies. We're on Twitter and Instagram at DepreshPod. Our Depression Mode newsletter is available for free on Substack. Search that up. I'm on Twitter at John Moe. Hi, credits listeners. Jack Kerouac was one of the construction workers who built the Pentagon. He'd bring a pint of whiskey or gin to drink with him every day. He also did some writing. Depeche Mode is produced by Gabe Mara. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. Rhett Miller wrote and performed our theme song, Building Wings.
I'm always falling off of cliffs now, building wings on the way down. I am figuring things out, building wings, building wings, building wings. No one knows the reason, maybe there's no reason, I just keep believing. No one knows the answer, maybe there's no answer, I just keep on dancing.
This is Jules from New Haven, Connecticut, and I just wanted to remind you that you are allowed to feel your feelings, even the bad ones.
Depeche Mode is a production of Maximum Fun and Papa Chick. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.